handle the truth.
Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Prick Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. It is Sunday, June 13th, 5:30 p.m. in the year of our Lord, 2021. Doing this early. Going to post it early just because I have an extremely busy week of day job work. Plus, then on Friday and Saturday, a seamless plug, I am opening for Roy Wood Jr. at Governor's in Levittown, Long Island. So, final reminder to go get yourself tickets to that if you are... I have no idea. I know I have friends in Long Island, but I don't know if I have any fans or listeners out there. So, this is your final podcast warning. That's not true. You'll also get one on Making Podcasts Great Again if you do listen to that one as well, my wildly more successful podcast. And so it's a very busy week for me, making multiple videos, a shit ton of billable hours to do at the day job, and then some road work Friday, Saturday. So I figured I had a little time on Sunday. I'd just get this out. Not that I don't care about it, but I just figured when was the best time for me to record this. But I'm also very impatient. I don't like sort of recording and then being like, okay, and that's uploaded for Tuesday. Enjoy. Not afraid of podcasting early. Thank you, everybody who showed up in Hartford. A lot of Righteous Prick fans. I appreciate that, which is what I expected. I expect the more casual fans of like one character of mine maybe not to be as dedicated, but there were some Making Podcasts Great Again fans, but special bonus star for those who listened to the Righteous Prick podcast and showed up. Cut to the chase. The set went well. Chris Lamberth, my buddy, opened up for me, friend of the podcast, friend in real life. And this is one of the realities, obviously, of doing comedy. I have I'm recording a special / album in October in New York City. I will put the ticket link on my website this week. But if you go to triadnyc.com, you can get tickets right now if you're listening to this. October 23rd, two shows. So I'm working on a variety of material. Some is sort of your standard Zoom show stuff that I was working on during the pandemic, and a few of the live shows that I've done. And there's some more ambitious stuff that I'm starting to work on, and Hartford was the first venue where I was starting to leak out some of that material. And some of it needs work, et cetera, but the crowd was really nice. The downside was the crowd was much smaller than I'd hoped. I mean, they comped a bunch of people, so it wasn't like it wasn't empty or anything, and then they were limited to half capacity at the club anyway. But, you know, the club... I know them there. I know a few of the staff. I know the manager. They've always been nice to me, but I do wonder why their Instagram and Facebook haven't like been updated in a year plus, or Twitter. Actually, no, I'm sorry, Twitter and Instagram. I don't know what their Facebook promotion is, but I'm sort of like, you are a mainstream A-list club in your area, and your social medias are defunct. Like, that's you know, that's one of those things that you're sort of like, it'd be great to get a boost from the club. But, you know, the people who did show up, I'm grateful for. I'm not even in the mood until July to reach out to the Funny Bone chains, because this very well could have been exactly what they wanted, which is like the club doesn't promote anyway. So I just, you know, had a mediocre showing. And then they don't have to give me more spots at other places. I could be wrong, but, you know, this is my fatigued, resigned to mediocrity voice, not my righteously indignant spirit. Too tired on a Sunday. Hit the gym this morning, lifted weights for the first time in, what, I don't know, 8 months. And I'd say my strength level was the probably the equivalent of the 5 foot big bootied chick that was working out near me in the gym. So if you're asking my strength levels, you know, 4 years ago, angry large man with something to prove strength level, today, big bootied 5 foot woman at the gym. So extremely weak. Some of that is due to nerve issues with my spinal injury from 2018. But overall, you know, you just got to check the ego, because this is about life now. And there's no more excuses. I got to get to the gym. My gym makes me wear a mask, which is fine. But, you know, I just feel like shit and look like shit. So it's time to do some shit. Okay, how about that? But so Hartford, you know, it's always you don't want to sound ungrateful, because it was great meeting fans, both longtime fans and many new fans. So there's no the first and foremost, you want to be grateful for that, and I am. But you know, maybe it's one show is not enough to gauge, obviously, but. Yeah, it was a little disappointing, but whatever. I still had a nice time, hung out with Chris, had IHOP the next day. So all the side dishes of my trip were excellent. Just the main course was a small portioned steak. But so that's Hartford. I didn't do a road recap, because it was I'm above doing a one nighter, but. You know, if you want to see just any of the clips from Hartford, I posted like a little medley on Twitter and Facebook on Saturday for Stand Up Saturday clips, and on Instagram. So, yeah, and by the way, once again, just to reiterate, if you're following me on one platform and you are on multiple platforms, I am on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So, you know, just because of the algorithm on Twitter, which is obviously my most successful platform, don't be bashful about following me or friending me or whatever on the other platforms. Just, you know, some of you see almost all my stuff, but there's plenty of people who, like a guy asked me last night during the Jazz game when I tweeted something, he was like, "You're a Jazz fan?" And I was like, I feel like this is good proof of suppression of my content. Yeah, I'm a Jazz fan. I guess you missed over the last 7 months the, you know, hundreds of Jazz-related tweets. I guess you just missed every single one of those. So if you're on other platforms besides Twitter, or other platforms besides Instagram, or other platforms besides Facebook, follow me on multiple ones. Not because I need the ego boost, but just because it's the best way to get my shit seen. And obviously, you know, I always make this call to action for people to sign up for my newsletter, and I don't think people believe it, because they're like, "Well, I'm seeing this tweet, so I don't need to sign up for your newsletter, because if I see this one tweet, I assume I will see all the tweets." That's a bad assumption. But I added like 40 last week, and I was looking at my numbers, and I'm like, all right, so like 1,200 people are signed up for my monthly newsletter, and 147,000 people follow me on social media. So we're clicking in at, What is that? Well, it's certainly not 1%. That, I don't know. I don't mean to be despondent so early. I'm too tired, I think. I think this would be better if I could transfer this to Rage. But among the shows coming up, obviously Long Island, Boston folks, I'm going to be making a big push, obviously, with Williams College alum associations, with friends out there and with fans. So Boston, the tickets go on sale this Friday, the 18th, I was told. But I'm at City Winery in Boston on Monday, June 26th at 8 p.m. Pete Dominic is going to be opening for me, so that's going to be a really good show, and I'm looking forward to it. But it's a lot of stress, too. You know, until you become super established, you know, I as we all know, I don't have an agent doing any of this stuff for me. So it's like every element of pressure. I just didn't think there'd be this much pressure. I really thought, like, I was, you know, telling, like, late last year when I just assumed when things opened up, somebody would want to, I'd be getting booked, God forbid, at the clubs. You know, sorry to keep doing it, but, like, you know, another week I sent out another round of emails and I sent Facebook messages to a couple of the people that I knew specifically from some of the clubs that have been, that I've had long relationships with that are not replying to me in any capacity whatsoever, even to say no. That's what I find really weird. It's just, it's bumming me out because I'm actually going to have, just bear with me. I've got some other things to talk about on this episode. That'll be fun. But I'm on pace for 2021. To have fewer bookings than 2019. Now, how could anybody not despair at that? And the only other option is, you know, insane rage, and I'm trying not to have that. That's no fun for everybody. But in 2019, the year that convinced me to basically, quitting is a strong word, but the 2019 was the straw that broke my comedy career's back. I had done, you know, every year I accomplish something that keeps me in the game, but it never snowballs. So, like, we can go through my career. 2007, late night debut, crush it, look like a fucking beast on camera. Various things happened. My manager that of like 4 months, nobody had signed me, but they were working with me, I guess, as like a trial balloon to see if I could pull off some shit. I get that and I get another TV credit. They fire my manager like a week before my second TV credit, which was a regional thing, but it was a sports themed comedy show, stand-up show, hosted by Gary Gulman. Actually, if you look on my YouTube, it's like one of the first clips ever I posted to YouTube. But that went really well. So two clips, one regional, one national, Late Late Show being another one. So I'm like, okay, boom. Well, then my manager gets fired from the agency. They lose interest in me because he was the sort of person who was most interested. Late Late Show, which was going to book me again, won't even return my emails once I lost management. Okay, boom. 2009 happens. I got money in the bank. I'm coming off a broken off engagement. And I get laid off from my firm. So I go, okay, well, my late night credit's still kind of fresh. And I got money in the bank, so let's do this. So I feature at a bunch of places. I start trying to do the road, taking every gig I can, even if I'm only going to profit $20, because I figure that's the way to do it. And 3 years later, I'm doing part-time work in my mom's office because, you know, I had to stay flexible for comedy, but I had no more money. So then in 2013, working in my mom's office, I continue to make, basically pay my sketch, like use the money I'm making for bills and for sketches. So I do the Louis C.K. sketch and that goes viral. I have meetings with two different managers. They don't want to sign me. They asked me to meet with them. They initiated the meeting. So let that be a lesson. One viral video in 2013 got me two manager inquiries in 2013. The year I had in 2020 got me zero. So that's fun. That's not actually true. It got me one. which I then was very displeased with. Basically, I was very displeased because it was like, having a manager should definitely get me more than not having a manager, and it wasn't. So, double. My one viral video in 2013 got me double the management interest that the year I had and the press coverage I had in 2020 got me. So that's weird. But 2013, I put out Keep My Enemies Closer. I remember that was a low point also, oddly enough, because my first album was in 2006 and I sold out the room. The same room now that I'm doing my new special in, you know, kind of bring it all full circle. I sold out the room. Six people got rejected from the door because it was a capacity crowd. The next one I did in 2008, I sold 110 tickets out of 130 possible seats. By the time we get to, then my third album was in Philly at Helium. I had to rent Helium. I'd been a feature there a couple of times, and I asked them if they could book me, and they said I could rent it for $1,000. So I sold 66 tickets, and they comped 65 people. So I had a nice crowd for Too Big to Fail. I also lost $340 simply on doing the show. Doing the show cost me $340, despite having 130 people in the audience and selling 66 tickets on a Wednesday. Cool. Cool industry, right? and then Keep My Enemies Closer comes, and that album took me 15 months from first joke, writing the first joke for that album to being ready. It took me like 15 months, and it's a fucking beast. And I'm so proud of it, but it was also, it speaks to people sometimes ask me about my process, and I'm like, I don't want to sound pretentious or anything, but it's like the process, there is no process. Like my albums don't come out at a regular interval, at regular intervals. They come out when I'm ready. So like Diamond Maker took 2 years, Too Big to Fail took 4 years. And Keep My Enemies Closer, I think my best album, took me 15 months. And it's chock full. It's an absolute beast. But I was very excited about the material. So I went to the Triad Theater, home of two of my first three albums, and sold 27 tickets. And man, thank God I believed in the album, like the material. I couldn't put out that show, because I might as well have been doing it in my apartment by myself. But I believed in the material and I was right, but I said, I can't put that album out. So I then went to the Laughing Devil Club, which then became the Laughing Stand and then which closed. But when it was the Laughing Devil, I got 20, it was a room that sat like 40 people. I probably had like a crowd of 27, but that 27 in a room that sits 40 sounds different than a 27 in a room that seats 130. And I murdered it. I crushed it. And I remember Rich Voss said on his podcast a couple of years ago, he was like, this guy, he's not just the guy who did the Louis C.K. impression. He's actually a pretty good stand-up. I heard some of his stuff on Sirius. Didn't sound like anybody was in the room, but it was funny stuff. And I was like, there it is. That is an incredibly accurate assessment, which is always nice. You know, it hasn't done anything for me, but it's always nice when Jim Gaffigan calls you brilliant on Pete Holmes' podcast, you know, a few months after your Louis C.K. video, because he's reading your blog and checking out your other stuff. That's a nice thing when you hear that. When Rich Voss is on his own podcast randomly shouting you out, that feels good. But I had to re-record the album. So if you've listened to Keep My Enemies Closer, if you have it, I think it's like 20, is it 24 tracks? It's either 20 or 24 tracks. Three tracks in the middle are from the Triad set because I didn't do them, but they were good enough. They were good enough jokes that I wanted on the album. So 90% of the album is one take at the Laughing Devil, and the other three are one take from the Triad. So then we get to Israeli Tortoise, which was then at the Standing Room, which was the rebranded Laughing Devil. Now, once again, that was a show where, what did I get? $75 a show to headline my own room, and I sold it out. It was 40 seats, but I sold out both shows. I think I made $150 selling out two shows for my own album. Which is better than what happened in Too Big to Fail, where I cost me $340 just to re- just to be in the club. Too Big to Fail. Israeli Tortoise sold out, but and some of that was assisted by the fact that I had been now a steady regular for 3 years as a regular guest on the Adam Carolla Show. Once again, something I did on my own, and that was good. Some Carolla fans showed up, friends showed up, longtime fans showed up. My relationship with the black guy who tips at that point was paying real dividends. Because there were those lean years where he was, Rod and Karen were, the biggest source of fans for me. So those turned out successful. Those give me some hope. Then I get started getting played on ESPN radio for a couple of years, with my Trump impression, which I kept wondering, why is nobody recognizing my Trump impression? There was a big industry built around getting actors and comedians work on their Trump impressions, and mine is like has been featured on the Adam Carolla Show, one of the biggest podcasts in the world, and the like one of the top rated sports programs and sports radio, the Dan Le Batard Show, and nothing was happening beyond that. People liked it. Some YouTube videos that I put out got some views, but nothing was really happening beyond that. So then I do thoughts and prayers. I did thoughts and prayers, and then I remember somebody yelling at me on Instagram, like, that's Anthony Jeselnik's album title. And I said, check the spelling of mine. It means something different. It's a pun. Mine's a pun. His was the actual phrase. Mine's a pun on the phrase. And his response, which was a harbinger of the internet for me, was, whatever you say, man. And I was like, no, it's not. It's a different word. It was one of those bizarre things where it's like, you're wrong. I'm not being a jerk about it, but now you're being a jerk insisting that my being correct is actually very wrong. Not afraid of homonyms. So, thoughts and prayers. I remember when that show was done, that was a new sensation for me. Cue the in excess. Just a great sense of relief. I remember I felt exhausted when that show, because I had one take and I ended up doing a double album. It's like 100 minutes or 98 minutes of comedy. And I really believed in it. And there were some more risk. There were some more risky bits for sure on that album. And when I was done and the crowd was so good in Philly, and they finally, hey, how about that? Helium in Philly paid me, I think, $250 to do the show. I no longer had to rent because I had now done, this was my second album at Helium. It was a different manager, and I'd also featured there like seven times, so I guess I had earned some modicum of respect. Not afraid of earning money. But I felt such relief, but I knew I had made a really good album. And it didn't sell particularly well, even on the basis of my own career of, here's a new album. Oh, good. I'm number one for 19 hours, and you know, may sold X number of copies. It didn't sell well, even for me, and that was, you know, disheartening. But it was a wake up call. I was just like, it doesn't really matter how good I am or how hard I work, and that's, you know, that's life. But I thought at that point, when 2019 hit, and I had a bunch of gigs early in the year, like January, February, March. And then I only got one more gig in May headlining the Ann Arbor Comedy Showcase, which went really well. They told me they'd bring me back in 2020. I got famous in 2020, and now they don't return my emails in 2021. I don't understand. That's one of the other clubs that, like, I'm like at best perplexed, and my worst moments deeply, deeply insulted and enraged. But I got that gig. They gave me that gig. Like, I got a late May gig in like March. So March was the last time someone booked me until October, when I got a weekend featuring at a Long Island comedy club, like kind of not last minute, but like something had obviously opened up. And then Magoobies outside of Baltimore booked me for feature work in November. Or I may have that reversed. It may be like October, November, November, October. But then that was it. But in the aggregate, I thought 2019 was like one of the worst years because I was just like, I want my good work to be rewarded, and it's just not. And that's life. But at the same time, you're human. You're like, I can't keep working for like, you know, just for the sake of making something. Like I'm at a phase where I need it. I need some career advancement, not just, well, that's a good album, and the nine people who eventually hear that will say, hey, this guy was pretty good. I can't do that. So 2019, an agency that I've been doing temporary legal work with for like 5 years. That's how I was filling in the money gaps from 2014 to 2019. Said this big firm was hiring, and I've always had whatever as a lawyer, but I have a good resume and I have a good, a couple of good diplomas hanging in my closet. And a lot of these big firms, they'll want some pedigree with the people they hire. So went in, got hired, and said, okay. I just didn't think I could pass up. I just turned 40, and I didn't think I could pass up a job anymore. Like, I couldn't keep saying, I need to be free. Why? People aren't booking me. So why do I need to? Like, there was a rationale, and in some years it was validated. But it didn't seem valid anymore to just say, I need flexibility. So I need to sacrifice. I need to pay for my benefits myself and make a third or half of what I could be making through a day job, because I need my art requires me to be free. I couldn't really mentally validate that or justify that anymore. So I took that, I moved to Jersey, and that was basically, it wasn't quitting, but it was basically like, if I'm at the point in my career where I'm holding on for a miracle, then is a day job going to really stop a miracle from happening? is a day job really going to be the problem here? The problem is nobody's booking me. Nobody cares. So like, I'd rather have a day job and benefits and have those people not care than to not have those things and have people not care. And then obviously, if you're listening to this still, not afraid of turning off the podcast, then you know what happened in 2020, the equivalent of a comedy miracle, a global crisis and tragedy, but a comedy miracle. And it made me rethink everything. And I wish it hadn't, because I've never been more stressed about my comedy career now than I've never been more stressed in my life than I have been this last year. And it feels very bad. I don't like it. I was not stressed like this. I was sleeping. I was having a comfortable life in 2019, like late 2019 and early 2020. And it's just weird. I'm sure there's people out there who COVID shook up their life in a really bad way, and that's why they're sad or depressed. And I get that. And I'm not comparing mine, but it's starting to feel like 2020 kind of ruined my life. It may have helped my bank account, but I don't know. I didn't feel this bad in law school, which is what drove me to comedy. So it's a very weird feeling, because, they say money, and it wasn't about the money. The money's nice that I made, but it's about, can I just be happy? And I felt like I was maybe getting there, deprioritizing comedy. But then they woke up the dream. The dream like was dusted off and woken from a slumber. And to see it dying like this feels cruel. If my comedy dream were an animal, it'd be like abuse. It's just like it was dying with dignity in 2019. I'd fought the good fight, and now I could find some happiness. I still remember, I was like, we moved out here, and I ate IHOP. I was happy to be living near an IHOP. And then, that Friday after work, or did I take off? No, I worked. I took off for like moving day, and then I worked that Friday, and then we went to a new, like a local theater, not local, but local, took a cab to see Joker, had a nice burger at like a dine-in theater, and it was just like a good start to a new life. And then I wrote a pilot in the library on the weekends just to as a creative outlet. I thought it was funny. I'm a funny guy. I don't know how good a writer I am as far as a sitcom script writing, but I thought it was pretty funny, at least in my own head. Now it's office based. So obviously, as it would happen to me, the script is basically 90% invalid based on the new life that we all have. But now we get to here, and I'm not, I've got a couple of milestones this year, and I'm trying to stay focused on those. Working with Roy Wood Jr. He asked for me. That's great. The last headliner that wasn't a friend. And when I say friend, I'm not friendly with Roy Wood, but I'm saying the last, you know, my friend Rob Mayer asked when he knew I was struggling, which was a really cool thing. He had gotten me a feature spot for him at Magoobies. And they'd already worked me at Magoobies, but he kind of just like, you know, he knew from this depressing podcast that I was like hard up for work. And I said the only two comics who ever asked me to open for them specifically were Patrice O'Neill and Rob Mayer. It's a real Magic and Larry Bird of comedy. and Roy Wood is only the second sort of star comedian that's not an actual real life hung out with you friend. You know, and that's a nice opportunity. Maybe it's just a one-off, but who knows? Maybe that's a relationship that could, but I don't even try to think of that because I'm at the point now where I just have to say, fuck expectations, fuck dreaming. I mean, if I had told you the things I was saying in 2020, I was being so cautious. All my friends said to me, this is your time. And I said, we'll see. And they're like, why are you so negative? And I said, we'll see. Because I told people, when I have an agent or I have a tour, that's when I'll feel safe. And neither of those things happened. So we all know what happened with lip syncing for 8 months. It became the greatest form of art that we've ever witnessed. And I kept putting out good stuff. I kept getting good coverage in the media. So like, I don't know. It kept me grounded. It didn't, my negative mindset, which bore out to be completely validated, didn't affect the comedy I was putting out in any way. It just helped me be a little more prepared for sadness and disappointment. But now I don't know. I have that. I have the show in Boston, which I had to, you know, the club in Boston hasn't returned my emails in 5 years, even though they booked me in like 2012 and 2013. They replied to one email, I think in 2015 when Laughs Boston opened, and they have other venues too. And they never reply to my emails. So I booked an independent venue that's well established and big. And I'm putting my faith in, you know, the Williams College Alumni Network and from what I've been told from Jay on Making Podcasts Great, and Boston was our number one city in the country for the podcast. Now, maybe half of those people have stopped listening, but, you know, it made Boston a sensible place to take a risk. So I hope it's a big show. Hope we do well. And then the album recording on October 23rd. So those are things that, you know, will keep me engaged in terms of the work. Like, I take pride in my work, so I'm like I have reasons to be engaged. But yeah, it's no good. It's just not a good business. I think the culture around comedy, I think people's sensibilities, and this isn't just some bitching about PC culture. In fact, it really isn't. I don't know. I feel like the culture of comedians, I feel like the industry, and I feel like audience members, they're all, you know, maybe I'll be lucky to quit after the album and just say, okay, there it is. That's a wrap. I've been on TV. I was helpful to a lot of people during a historically bad time. I will always forever be the undercard to Sarah Cooper in that respect, but that's okay because why would I want to be a comedian in an industry and for an audience that values that over what I did? And if you do, that's okay. You don't listen to this podcast, but I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm not saying you're not entitled to your opinion. Comedy is subjective, but why would I want to, what hope would there be if what I do could be judged inferior to a degree of 10 when you look at money and opportunities, maybe to a degree of 100, then what's the point? Why would I want to stay in that business? Like, it's like, okay, I get it. Like, I was the right man for the wrong time or whatever, the wrong man for the right time. But, you know, I have to start the process of mentally divorcing myself from comedy again, the way I did in 2019, except this is much more brutal because my hopes have never been higher than they were in 2020. I was talking about like, well, what if I get a special somewhere? Or, you know, maybe I can get a tour and then we can buy something. Like, and I'm not complaining. I just was talking about bullshit that seems like so stupid in hindsight, but it really didn't seem stupid at the time. It really felt like I was on the cusp of something big, and it didn't happen, and that's okay. But I'm just telling you, that's why, you know, how can you keep doing, how could one keep doing comedy with all this, like with all the evidence in front of me? And people always say, you're not going to quit. And I go, well, I basically did in 2019. Like, not fully, but without 2020, I just would have been on the same trajectory of like, hey, I do some feature work and boom. So all that happened was that I had this outlier year that then regressed violently to the mean. For my career, which is I didn't see happening. I didn't see getting fewer gigs. I mean, think about it, guys, while you're listening to me. I know this is so far kind of a bummer, but when you're listening to this, you've got to laugh a little bit. Like, who knew the JL could actually have wild success and it would then lead to less success than he had when he was unsuccessful? I mean, the idea of booking fewer gigs this year than I did in 2019 is insane. Like, it's like very dark comedy, and I don't know who's laughing, if it's God or whatever, but it's incredibly dark comedy. But it just, you just have to, I just have to accept it. I think I have work to do. Comedically, I have sketches I've written. I have some good stuff coming up even this week. I finally, The Righteous Girlfriend finally got the order of some pints of Colin Kaepernick's Ben & Jerry's ice cream. So on Monday night, after making Podcast Great Again, I'm going to do another mukbang video, which are those like overeating videos. And it's just going to be me as Trump eating and doing commentary on the Ben & Jerry's Kaepernick ice cream. And then I have some TikToks thought up where I bought a Kaepernick shirt and a big afro, and I'm going to do a series of TikToks where Kaepernick gives many of my impressions, Cuomo, Don Jr., Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, Mike Lindell, Dave Chappelle, gives them like interrupts like a 20-second bitch session and then hands them his ice cream and then they eat it and then funny things ensue. So I can't turn that off. I've got funny stuff that I'm working on, and I got the album/special. Now, I'm going to probably end up investing in the special to make it like really good. I'm going to start inquiring in late June, early July. Like, people, it's like, who did yours? Who filmed yours? Like, I'd like this to be maybe almost a documentary crew follow me the day of the special through New Jersey, or I, you know, a little bio early on, and then we film and we edit, and I want it to be like a Netflix HBO quality production. You know, not for $100,000, obviously, but you know, I'm willing to put high fours to low five figures into this if it makes a good product. But I also have to steel myself for the idea of like, oh, you're gonna make a great special, but if you can't get clubs to reply to your emails to like headline on a Wednesday in Philadelphia, fairly unlikely that Netflix and HBO and Showtime and Amazon will return your emails, or even if you get a representative. Like, so it's still high, it's a high risk, low reward. Maybe that should be the title of my album. It's not, but that should be the title of my biography. How about that? High risk, low reward, my life as an almost success in comedy. coming to you from self-publishing, of course. But I just have to start mentally divorcing myself from comedy. That doesn't mean I want you to stop listening. Like I said, as long as I'm doing it, then I'm doing it. But mentally, I can't keep taking the disappointment, because the disappointment of 2021 has been like deep and shocking. And, you know, at that, I can't keep putting myself into that situation. The difference between 2019 and 2021 is my expectations were at rock bottom by the time I took the job. I took the job as a surrender. I was like, I get it. It's not happening. But the idea that I could have everything happen in 2020, that the industry, like, okay, so fame and skills and varied content and huge press coverage, and that I can't get an agent, a manager, or most clubs to return my email for off-night bookings, then what? There is nothing else in this business that I have chosen to pursue. So I have to start the process of mentally divorcing myself from expectations and just say, all the goals, kick ass in Long Island, kick ass in Boston, kick ass on October 23rd, hopefully fill in some gaps with some gigs. I need to. I can't just fucking do three shows. That's the other issue, is like, I need gigs to warm up for the big gigs. So that's why Hartford, even though it was disappointing, like most things in my comedy career, it was useful and helpful. And I said to the crowd after the show, I said, I tried to give you 100% effort, even if the material was only at about 75%. You know, you deserve at least the effort, but there is a process to this. And as you know, we've been locked away for most of a year plus. And, you know, some of these jokes have to get worked out on crowds. But, yeah, so you know, just, you know, Long Island, Boston, New York. Ticket links for Boston should be up Friday at City Winery in Boston. I'm going to post sometime this week the link to my website. But if you go to triadnyc.com, you can get tickets now. Tell your friends, tell people who knew me, tell people who liked me, that you communicate with if they're not on social media, that I got a big show. You know, that kind of shit. Anyway, I promised you more upbeat stuff after that epic of sadness. So, In the Heights. Guys, I saw In the Heights on HBO Max. I was looking forward to it. I saw my brother has bragging rights on Hamilton. He saw it with his wife at Joe's Public Theater. So he saw it like when it was just getting that buzz before it even blew up. I saw it first run orchestra seats August 2015. And the orchestra seats that I had, aisle, $129 a ticket. The next time I bought tickets, they were like, what were they? $280 or something, and then I ended up selling them because I needed money. That's the one good thing of if you get some good tickets. I wanted to see it again, but then I was like, I need to pay rent right now, and and I sold them for $500 a pop. So I made they were like $250. They were $250. Were they even $250? No, they were like $200 a pop. The ones I got like on a second run, but then I sold them for $1,000. Like I made $1,000 selling them on Ticketmaster because I was like, I need this money now. So thank you, Hamilton. And that was a joke on Israeli Tortoise. I said, I sold my Hamilton tickets. It wasn't to pay for the recording, but it was like around that time. And I was like, so that money is being used to fund this recording. So that's why the first track on Israeli Tortoise is called Lin-Manuel Miranda Presents Jean-Louis Cauvin. But yeah, In the Heights. I think it was probably an awesome musical. It did win the Tony for Best Musical, and then, you know, his next fucking project was Hamilton. So it had the feel of a fun, big Broadway musical. As a movie, I thought it was all right. I thought it was very cool. I found out from my mom, who wants to see In the Heights because she grew up in Washington Heights, or as I said on Twitter, In the Heights, because that's when it was all Irish and Jewish. But they actually did film all over Washington Heights, so she wants to see it for like nostalgia. And I thought that was cool. That's pretty impressive that they were able to film all that shit in Washington Heights. But I just didn't. It was a long ass movie, and you know, there's obviously talent involved, but I just didn't. I was just like, I was looking forward to it. The expectations couldn't have been higher from Hamilton. The reviews were all going gaga over in the Heights, so I was like, okay, it's probably legit. I was just okay with it. In the words of Randy Jackson, it was just aight for me. And I guess I'm just not going to see any more John Chu movies. I think that's John Chu or John Cho. The guy who directed Crazy Rich Asians and then directed this, he's obviously very successful. I fucking hated Crazy Rich Asians. I couldn't understand. Like, Crazy Rich Asians was one of those movies I didn't see in the theater. Not because I just was like, I'll catch it sometime. But then the reviews were so good, and people were like, should it have been nominated for some Oscars? And I was like, oh, okay. Well, let's see what you got, Crazy Rich Asians. And then I watched it, and I was like, am I missing something? Because this movie sucks. And that was what was so weird about Crazy Rich Asians is usually when I'm hating, quote-unquote, on something, it's because I'm like, it's good, but I think you guys are all overhyping it. But Crazy Rich Asians, there was like a complete disconnect. I was like, I don't actually understand why I don't understand why this got such great reviews. I think this movie sucks. Like, that was so weird about Crazy Rich Asians, because it rarely happens that I go, oh, you think it's an A? I think it's a D minus. It's usually like, you think it's an A plus, I think it's a B plus. And then you get into arguments where people treat you like you just told their favorite movie is a fucking child rapist. But with Crazy Rich Asians, yeah, that movie was a child rapist. Just metaphorically speaking, you know, the metaphor I just made. But it was, I hated Crazy Rich Asians. I don't know why. I can't stop thinking about how much I was like so unhappy watching that movie. Just, it felt like shit. And In the Heights, better than Crazy Rich Asians. But like, I think sometimes it's a type of musical. Like Chicago, the movie, I thought was really good. And maybe that was just because it was like an older styled musical. And like La La Land was really good. But that was also a musical made for theater, like made for the movie theater. It wasn't like an adaptation from a Broadway musical that they were trying to keep authentic and real to the original. In the Heights just felt so big that I was like, I'd rather just see this on Broadway, like bring it back on Broadway, do a revival. It probably is super big and super fun. And the movie was just fine for me. Like I didn't like particularly enjoy it as much as I thought I would. And one of the funniest things that I thought of watching In the Heights was something about the way Lin-Manuel Miranda writes. You know, you've got the hip hop kind of infused stuff, but then whenever women show up, their songs are always like, except for one, they had like a beauty shop song that was very boisterous. But whenever there's like mixed gender singing, I was laughing thinking about this last night, and I think I made the Righteous Girlfriend laugh, although she just doesn't want to laugh at me. And the greatest compliment is that she laughs at me the way she laughed at Bo Burnham's special, which is with head shaking and like she just goes. Like she's trying to hold in the laughter. And I was like, oh, well, if you're laughing at Bo Burnham's special that way, then I'm in great company. But it was one of those things where I was watching every time. It's like a dude comes in and is like, we're in the Heights. Like just with the hip hop swagger. Like, we're in the Heights. We're doing it live. We're eating under blah, 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 blah. And then like, then it picks up speed and it's like the bam ba da ba 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 da ba. And then some woman will always come in with like, I'm sad. Either like I'm depressed, I'm sad, or like I'm afraid of leaving. And then it gets back to the dudes and it made me laugh. It made me laugh thinking of that dichotomy. And I was trying to think, do they have that in Hamilton? And there's like always like an one upbeat womanly song. Test this out. Like the next thing Lin-Manuel Miranda does, who knows what it'll be, but if he does another Broadway show in like 3 years, watch out for like all the dudes just with swagger and hip-hop flavor, and then there'll be one upbeat song with women. One. Like the Skylar sisters in Hamilton, I think, was like an upbeat kind of. But then everything else is like, why are you cheating on me? Or I'm so sad. Or he's so distant. I just thought that was funny.
Does Lin-Manuel Miranda have a blind spot for the joys of women? Not afraid of critiquing Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I'm in the Heights. I'm selling the quarter waters. I'm having the blah, blah, blah. I'm blah, 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 blah. I can't pay my tuition. We're dancing in the street. I'm beating my meat because I'm going through nasty puberty. My boyfriend cheated on me. We're in the Heights. Anyway, that's my review of In the Heights. Not worth 5 hours to watch it on HBO Max. But I know everybody loves it. Everybody's saying it's so good. So I'm just being a hater. I don't know. Maybe I just don't have. No, you know what? I do have joy. I do have joy. And it's basically right now Bo Burnham. Bo Burnham is like, I've watched his special now. Let me put it this way. When the Jazz lost badly in game 3 of their series, which is another thing I'm starting to realize. I don't know what's going on in my head. I'm starting to not be able to like deal with even things that bring me enjoyment. Like I've never been this stressed about basketball. Not when I played it. Not when the Jazz were in the finals against Michael Jordan. I've never been this stressed about basketball. And I think there's something else at play there. And I'm like, I was like stressed today about the fact that the Jazz lost in a different way. Not just like, oh damn, I hope they win. I was just like, it's almost like I have stress or anxiety, and then it's just like finding something to attach to. So this morning it was the Utah Jazz losing. But last night after the Jazz lost, I then just watched Bo Burnham's special again because it's just, it takes me away. It's funny. It's thoughtful. It's genius. And I was just like, yeah, I'm just like, this is what I need. And it's what I said to, what I was saying yesterday was it's like an album of comedy. And I don't mean that like a comedy. It's like I can listen to, I got this new album. I'm going to listen to, oh, I love this song. I'm just going to play it on repeat for a few days. That's like what his special is. It's so catchy and so fun and so thought, like, but at times it's not fun, but you just are mesmerized by it. It's so good. It's so good. And it's better than In the Heights. So that's why I tweeted, not enough Bo Burnham for me during In the Heights. In the Hype, I think, will be the title of this podcast. Now, people are going to be like, why are we listening to a 39-minute, really depressing chronology of JL's career? And it's just because this is a Righteous Prick is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. Actually, you do. You're usually going to get two episodes per month that are thoughtful but depressing. One episode that's manically hilarious, and one episode that's a kind of quasi-mix. He's doing his podcast. He's super depressed. He's not feeling it. He wants to give comedy a rest. I don't like that he does comedy. That's Lin-Manuel Miranda presents JL's apartment throughout the last year. The role of a depressed songbird woman will be played by the Righteous Girlfriend, and JL will be the super depressed, hip-hop swaggering star who gets all the good songs, even if the tone of them is negative. I can't get emails returned from clubs. Why won't they show me love? He's always moping in the corner. Oh, I hope people make it through the depressing shit just to get to Lin-Manuel Miranda presents Depressed Comedian. He's from the Bronx, but he's living in Jersey because he didn't make it because Sinatra is wrong. Bars. That is. Maybe that's why I'm not. Maybe that's why I'm critiquing Lin-Manuel Miranda's structure, gendered rap and song structure, because that's my life. My life is me stomping around my apartment doing good stuff and feeling depressed about it, and then all you have left is time for your girlfriend to be like, "This is a bummer." What would her upbeat song be? I guess it would be when I got her some nice gifts with my COVID money, with my like COVID success money. I got her some like really nice gifts. I figured that was the least I could do for just like putting up with me. Like some high-end bag, a bike, and an iPad so far. Those are the big purchases. Everything else went into the bank. I bought myself nothing. I bought myself nothing but a dream. But now the dream's a nightmare. I want to scream. He really does scream a lot. It's unfortunate because he's gigantic. I'm gigantic and I act like a dick. Comedy's made me sick because I want to quit this shit. I'm starting to think he should really quit this shit. Oh, I hope some of you get to this part of the show. I promised I'd try to make it fun, and I feel like I'm finally hitting my stride as a parody of Lin-Manuel Miranda. Oh, God. Oh, boy. I'm doing podcasts. I'm making money. But why don't I find comedy funny? Nothing makes me laugh anymore because JL is a vicious bore. I may be a bore, but with this fame, I could get mad whores. You know I'm just saying that, but sometimes I'm thinking that, and I want to put on a hat and go outside and make my millions as a comedian, but I don't lip sync, so there's my career regressing to the median. That almost started to sound like Damon Wayans' bum character on In Living Color. Anyway, In Living Color, great sketch show, by the way. Check it out. It's 30 years old, so you should go check it out. One other thing to leave you with. I meant to talk about this during my Bo Burnham jerk-off session on the last podcast, but I saw a funny tweet. Somebody had retweeted it, but it was like Mike Birbiglia, one-man show, the White Leguizamo. He's doing one-man shows. They call him White Leguizamo. When you do one-man shows, it means comedy's a no-no, so you're backing up into a different medium. Are you Henry Rollins or are you a comedian? JL's losing his mind, jealous of other artists. That was actually pretty good, though. That was a pretty good synopsis of one-man shows. I once almost tweeted, how should I announce that I'm quitting stand-up comedy? Choice A, doing a stand-up comedy show. Choice B, doing a one-man show. Choice B, or choice two, however I numbered these, becoming a libertarian slash political pundit. But Birbiglia said something to the effect of, I see a lot of people, and you can tell from my tone that I'm not on his side. I see a lot of people saying, is Bo Burnham's special really comedy? And I've seen that with Hannah Gadsby's Nanette. And I've seen it with my own stuff. Just enjoy the art. And I almost replied like, please don't do that. Don't do Bo Burnham. And Hannah Gadsby and me are just out here for the art. Leave Bo Burnham alone. Bo Burnham is operating at a higher level. If you watch a... But I'm just saying, I don't like that. I don't think I would ever do that. I hope I wouldn't. I sometimes will say, I made that joke too. But I won't say, you know what? Like, if I saw somebody attacking a comedian I respected, who I felt like if somebody was, like, shitting on, I'm trying to, Gary, like, my influences, I'm not saying I'm a replica of any of these people, but, like, Gary Gulman, Patrice O'Neill, Greg Giraldo, those are my, like, three biggest influences. If somebody was shitting on Greg Giraldo's roast jokes, I wouldn't be like, you know what, Greg Giraldo is a smart former lawyer and gifted comedian, much like myself, can't you just let us do the work? No, I would just defend Greg Giraldo and let his greatness be on its own. But man, coasting in, just doing that doing that getting that, what's that thing when the swimmers, we won an Olympic medal when a dude did this, when you get in like their drift or something, like you like can actually pick up momentum from another swimmer's waves if they hug the line too much. I was just like, Mike Birbiglia, no. Bo Burnham, what he just did is probably already on my like Mount Rushmore of comedy specials. Bring the Pain is George Washington. Bring the Pain is my favorite all time. It's very hard. It will be very hard to unseat that because of what it means to me, the time in my life when I heard it, when I was just sort of getting to hear adult comedy. Bo Burnham Inside is like a truly unique peak of comedy. And I just found it so lame. I was like, yeah, nobody's going to be like, Nanette and Inside. Yeah, they're neck and neck. No. I don't care how many awards one of them won. No. And Burbiggs with the one-man shows, I've just always believed one-man shows. Hey, you can do a great one-man show. I've attended one-man shows of friends that I've enjoyed. But I do still think it's like there's stand-up comedy is a lot harder. And if you go from one to the other, it's a cop-out might be too mean a way of saying it. But yeah, it's a little bit of a tap-out. It's like playing doubles tennis. Like whenever people would be like, the Bryan brothers have won more doubles than anybody in the history of the game. I'm like, yeah, you know why? Because they would have been shit as singles players. They'd be getting their asses handed to them by Nadal, Federer, Djokovic, Murray, and probably three dozen other dudes. So spare me the awe for the doubles title, Bryan brothers. They've won more time. The reason we don't know any doubles players except for the Bryan brothers because they got a good agent probably. But like, it's get out of here. Get out of here with that. So Bo Burnham doesn't deserve to have one man shows and sob fests gliding in to get some of his wind at their backs. Okay. Bo Burnham stands alone right now. And speaking of which, it's probably time I go watch Bo Burnham special for a fifth time. It's becoming the dark night of comedy for me. If you don't know the dark night history for me, when I'd my engagement had broken off in early 2008, so the summer of 2008, with Coldplay's Viva La Vida and Timbaland's The Way I Are playing nonstop in my earbuds all summer. I went on I had a fun summer, and one of the things I did that summer is I saw The Dark Knight 8 times in the theater that summer. Four times with friends and four times on different second dates. It was just the easiest second date. It was like, "Hey, you want to catch a movie tonight? I hear The Dark Knight's real good." And, they probably knew I had seen it already when it was like, I was jerking off to like the car chase in downtown Chicago. And they were like, "I'm not that kind of girl." I'm like, "I'm not interested in you. I'm just very excited by this movie." So not afraid of revealing false stories that make me sound like a sexual criminal. This is the episode. I accomplished what I wanted. I laid out my entire history and why I am mentally separating myself from comedy as we speak. Until proven otherwise. And I do have somebody trying to book me an indie venue theater, an indie venue tour, which will be nice. And at the same time, will also probably remind me that I'm not getting the respect from the establishment. And once again, I have seen now people with agents who had similar years to me booking weekends at comedy clubs. So the only factor I can really figure is, well, I'm a more experienced stand-up comedian. I have more of a legacy. I have more credits as a stand-up comedian. But I don't have an agent. So I wonder if that's the X factor. Because if I'm besting people in every metric available as a comedian, except having an agent, and I'm getting zero club gigs and other people are getting weekends at clubs, it seems like the agent thing might be the thing stopping me from achieving my dreams. He can't achieve his dreams because he doesn't have an agent, but What rhymes with agent? Flagrant? Could I get away with that? Could I get away with flagrant? If I was Macklemore, I could. I realized he didn't rhyme anything in his big songs. It sounded like it was more like the beats just kind of were so good that you just kind of, your mind assumed there was a rhyme. Ah, oh, love me some Thrift Shop. Anyway, In the Heights. What rhymes with agent? Could I get away with flagrant? I don't know. He needs an agent or maybe a manager. A lot rhymes with manager. I don't know, guys. ASMR. No, but there's some fun videos coming your way, podcasts and shows. So that's it. I think we've done enough damage to me and to your ears for this week. Thank you for listening. That's it. So stay safe. Enjoy your life. Please get vaccinated. I start to judge people now who like, I've basically just made the choice that like, okay, I went into the supermarket today without a mask on. I'm allowed to go to church without a mask on. The only place I had to wear a mask today was my gym. So of course I did. But I did ask, I said, do I have to wear a mask if I'm fully vaccinated? And they were like, yep. And I was like, good deal. That's fine. Maybe you don't trust your members. That's okay. But I wish I start to look like I go to Starbucks to read and it's like 90% wear the masks. And I start to wonder, I'm like, some of you are being safe and I'm not going to complain at all about that. Some of you may not know the rules yet. May not know like, when do I have to, when can I not have the mask on? And then some people I'm like, go get the fucking vaccine. What are you doing? So I impart you with that wisdom, folks. Go get the fucking vaccine if you listen to this podcast. Is there anything else to tell you about? No. Just look for more videos. Be sure to follow me on multiple platforms. Just not for my ego, but just to make sure that as many people are seeing my stuff that want to see my stuff. So if you want to see my stuff or hear my stuff, the more platforms you follow me on, the better it is, in case one is fucking me over. I'm talking about you, Twitter. Oh, and I didn't get verified. Did I tell you I didn't get verified? They didn't verify me on Twitter, which was fun, I guess. You know, they required 3 or more national publications to write about me, so I provided 4. But they decided I shouldn't be verified. So whatever. I think I did talk about that last week. But if I didn't, there it is. Reason 900 that it doesn't seem to be working out for me, despite every sign in 2020 that it would work out. So I wish I could have bet against myself. You know what I mean? Like Pete Rose style. No, I wish I could have bet against myself. Somebody out there is going, Pete Rose always bet on his team. I know. God. But I wish I could have bet against myself. Like in June of 2020 and been like, I want a short JL. No. I know he's fucking killing it right now. I want to short JL. I want to invest all my money in the anticipated failure of the JL market. And man, imagine that if I could have shorted myself, I would have made so much fucking money. There's no way. Do you see how he's blowing up? Look at all the positive press coverage. And by the way, he's also a really good stand-up comic. When things open up, this guy's going to be in demand. I would like to bet everything against that happening. I am shorting JL with, I would like to take out more bank loans to short JL. I would, if I can get a million, I would take, can I take investors? Does anybody want to get in on this with me? JL, I am telling you, I have studied the JL market for 18 years. It may seem like this is his time, but what the market doesn't yet know is JL never has a time. Okay? So as great as it seems now, go invest in something smart like Bitcoin or Dogecoin or NFTs, which are failing now. The market's dried up, but go bet on them because it's still, there's a chance there. There is no chance with JL. The big JL short or in the hype. I'm going with in the hype as the title, but just so you know, if you've made it this far, the big JL short was a close second for the title of this episode. So thank you for listening. Stay safe. Hope to see you at some of my shows, and I will see you next Tuesday. Even though this episode went up on a Sunday, I will see you next Tuesday.